Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Busa takes government to court saying equity targets are rushed and irrational. A new health system warning from the body representing private healthcare funders. Asian tourists are vanishing from South Africa. Even fast-track visas can't mask our deeper tourism flaws. And illicit flows and dirty trade, corruption watchers demanding the G20 keep the fight alive. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of September. The country's biggest business lobby, Business Unity South Africa, has hauled government to court over new employment equity regulations. Busa says the process was, and I quote, rushed, the data opaque, and the targets misaligned, risking, it says, not only the credibility of transformation policy, but also the fragile trust needed between business and government. Let's explore this in a little more detail. Busa Chief Executive Officer Kulakane Mate, a very warm welcome to you. And let's start simply. Why have you decided you had no option but to go to court?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and thank you very much for the opportunity. Jeremy, we believe in constructive engagement whenever we face a challenge with government. We have a track record of collaborating with government to solve challenges. In this particular instance, Jeremy, as we describe in our statement, the process was rushed at the beginning of this year, not giving employers sufficient time to engage with the targets that were being imposed. To illustrate, in some instances, receiving the document a night before the actual meeting that was supposedly consultative, and one meeting had over 800 people participating online. A 1 hour meeting where there was absolutely no opportunity for really meaningful engagement. So clearly it was a tick box exercise here. And after that, we reached out to the minister and we asked and pleaded, in fact, with the minister to really engage meaningfully and address the concerns that we as business were raising. Unfortunately, our pleas were unheeded, and that left us no option because at that point, the regulations were introduced, coming into effect. And so we are approaching the courts to really look at the evidence that we provide, demonstrating that there was no meaningful consultation and various other deficiencies in the process, and set aside these regulations so that a thorough and proper process can be undertaken.
On the flip side, the department is insisting that the targets, in fact, accelerate transformation. Are you not concerned that your stance looks like business resisting change?
On the contrary, when you do a half-baked job and you do not follow the very law that empowers you to make regulations, you are putting those regulations at risk of being challenged. And this is what the department has done, because had the department, in the pursuit of transformation goals and objectives, followed the right process, that would be the part that accelerates transformation. Not doing so is what is leading to the situation that we find ourselves in. Jeremy, we are committed to transformation. We want it done, and we want it done right. But this action by the minister flies in the face of what is set out in the legislation around proper process and consultation.
I suspect you'll give me a similar answer, but there are critics, including some unions and even political voices, who are arguing that you are simply protecting old privilege under the guise of procedure. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, we And our papers demonstrate that we have been engaging in this process as far back in 2018. And so we've gone and tried to be as constructive as possible. Those critics might not have walked the journey that we have walked, and so making those criticisms. Our position is that done right, we support transformation fully and we want it implemented. And but what is happening is what is delaying transformation rather than our action.
So if you're serious then about transformation, what alternative process or framework would you support?
It's not so much about the alternative framework. The law, Section 15, capital A, sets out the process that must be followed because the amendments are new and they allow the minister or empower the minister to set numerical targets for various sectors. They also set out the process that must be followed in doing that. So we're not proposing an alternative framework. We're simply saying let's follow the framework that is before us and do it properly so that we can comply. If you don't do that, you make well-meaning companies to become non-compliant overnight just because the targets resulting from an unprocedural process have become irrational in some sectors, making it extremely difficult to comply. That is unfortunately not something that we would sit back and watch when companies that want to comply are suddenly made non-compliant overnight.
Well, let's pick up on one of those numerical targets. So the disability target, I understand, is increased to 3%. That's one example that you flagged. Why is that unrealistic in your view?
In fact, we asked the question of the department, what informs that target? There was no methodology that was applied. There was no analysis. The officials just thought, oh, well, 3% sounds like a good number. Now, and this is so in many, many instances where you ask for a methodology, scientific methodology that takes into account the supply side of the skills, the supply side of the training that you would require for people to then take up the opportunities when they are available. We were simply told that, well, that's not the minister's concern about the supply side issues. That is absurd. If you're going to set targets, you ought to be concerned about, are there people with the requisite skills, education to fulfill these roles? And so that same logic applies to how you set the disability targets. We absolutely support employment of more people with disability, but you don't want to shift the blame to companies when in fact there might not be people to fill those positions. And then companies are saddled with the non-compliance but just because a proper job was not done in looking at the supply side of this equation.
Just a quick one in conclusion. If the court rules against you, and I acknowledge this is a hypothetical question, what then? Would you comply or escalate the fight further, maybe even to the Constitutional Court?
Look, we approach the court because we have confidence in our judicial system in the country. And so, if for some reason we have misinterpreted the law and the court finds that actually the department has done things right, we will comply, because we are, law-abiding citizens as companies. But our contention is that the law was not followed, and that what resulted from that unprocedural process was irrational and unachievable.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Kulekani Mate, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Business Unity South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa has long spoken about the importance of attracting visitors from China and India, two of the world's biggest outbound tourism markets. Yet, despite promises of a fast-track visa system, the numbers are falling instead of rising. There's a new report out that shows both markets are slipping away at a time when our tourism sector badly needs growth and jobs. So to help us unpack, to explain why South Africa is losing out, I'm in conversation with Leanne Back, partner in Strategic Strategic Development and Advisory at the consulting firm BDO. Leanne, a very warm welcome. How big a setback is it then that we're losing visitors from these two key markets?
Jeremy, in reality, it's not such a big setback because we haven't actually ever achieved big numbers from these markets. But in reality, in comparison to other countries and our competitors, we are just not showing up at all. If you think about the size of the Chinese market, the outbound market in 2019, there were 155 million outbound Chinese traveling in 2019. And in that year, we had 93,000. If you think about that, that's an absolute minuscule little drop in the ocean, needle in the haystack. And then this year alone, for 7 months of the year, we received less than 24,000 Chinese visitors, which is only 44% of the numbers that we achieved in the same period in 2019. And this is despite the fact that we introduced the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme and put that in place. So we're just not getting any decent fair share. And if we want to move the needle on our tourism industry, this is the market that we need to actually look at. This is a market that can make a difference.
Leanne, beyond visas, and maybe we can talk a little bit more in detail about this fast-track system, what other barriers are keeping these tourists away? Is it flights to South Africa? I think probably not. Is it safety, or is it just general perception about South Africa that always plays against us?
It's the whole lot wrapped up together. It is a flights issue. We don't have very many direct flights to the east at all, which is a problem. And then those that are available, it's expensive to get here. So that is, and obviously we all know, increased supply and increased demand should start to lower ticket pricing. So that's one thing we need to look at. So in other words, just opening up our borders from a visa perspective is not the only solution. We also need to make sure that we've got a product and experience that caters to the needs of the Chinese market and the Indian market. We've got to understand those markets. And we need to have tour guides who can speak their language. We need to have food that caters to their specific requirements. We need to have products and experiences that they want to do, not what we think they want them to do, but what they would like to do. There's quite a lot of things we need to think.
Let's go back to the visa system, that fast track promise. What has happened that the system has not delivered the results that government earlier claimed that it would?
It could still be early days. I mean, bearing in mind that obviously people plan a holiday quite far in advance, and that the TTOS, as we call it, the Trusted Tour Operator Scheme, was only introduced in February. The data we're looking at is from January to July of this year. So it's a possibility that this hasn't come into play yet. But obviously, there's also perceptions in the market in terms of that South Africa's difficult to get to from a visa perspective, because it used to be very difficult to get a visa. So obviously, the TTOS is trying to overcome that, but you've got to get that message across that things are changing. But even better still, and we've got lots of hope within the tourism sector, is what the Minister Schreiber from Home Affairs announced last week, is the new electronic travel authorization, which they're actually implementing phase one for the G20 now. So for all Chinese, Indian, Mexican and Indonesian visitors coming for the G20, they will be using the new ETA, as they call it, which is a real groundbreaker when it comes to visas. It basically allows for online application, fully digitally orientated, and basically visas will be issued within hours and landing in basically in their wallet. And apparently this will be after the testing phase for the G20 from November. It will be introduced to those four markets for them to actually apply for visas. This is a real game changer, because then they don't have to come through a tour operator. They can come on their own, although we do know that a lot of the Chinese do travel through tour operators. But it does mean that we can get business tourists, we can get a lot more people coming in far easier into our market. So they're coming for conferences and things like that. So we're quite excited. But again, as I say, it's not just about facilitating the visa. We've got to get the message across that it's easy to get to South Africa. And then we need to make sure that we have the product and the experience that meets what they're looking for.
Leanne, in any way, has your company crunched the numbers in terms of economic consequence, either jobs, revenue or investment, if we continue to miss out on these two key markets?
I haven't actually done it of late for these two markets. We did do it in previous years. That was a good couple of 10 years ago, in fact. But we did crunch the numbers just in terms of the lost overseas visitors that we've lost this year, because our overseas tourism as a whole has not returned to 2019 levels yet. So we're still, this is overseas, so I'm not talking about our total international arrivals, but from an overseas perspective, we're still 10% behind 2019 levels, where a lot of our competitors are really way exceeded at. So if we have a look at it, there's 183,000 lost tourists, as I call it, overseas tourists, and that in direct spend alone for the first 7 months is 4.3 billion rand. So that excludes the indirect impact and all the sort of multiplier components of that money. That's directly lost to our economy. So you can see 183,000 tourists, 4.3 billion. Imagine, I mean, if you think about the 155 million outbound Chinese tourists, if we can just get 183,000, that's close to 4 billion rand that we can get back into our economy. So it's massive. It's big. It's huge, Jeremy. I mean, there's so much that we can achieve by growing our tourism industry.
And where do you think they are going? Who are we competing with aggressively?
So in terms of Africa, we have lost out quite a lot. South Africa used to be the largest tourism market on the African continent. This was in the early 2010s. And we have slowly lost ground over the years to Morocco, to Tunisia, to Kenya, to Tanzania. Although Kenya and Tanzania are still much smaller than us, but their growth has outpaced us. But Morocco, in 2016, Morocco and South Africa had a similar numbers of international arrivals of roughly 10 million. And Morocco is now sitting already in 2024, they were sitting at over 17 million arrivals compared to our poultry, less than 9 million. Wow. That is a concerted effort to drive tourism. Morocco has focused a lot on sports tourism, sporting events, to drive people into the country. They've looked at other events. They have had a big marketing drive, but it just, to me, it just goes to show the potential. Yes, you can say that they're close to a big source market in terms of Europe, but we're also close to a big source market in terms of Africa, which I don't believe we have capitalized on enough as well in terms of our African markets.
So, Leanne, just a quick one in conclusion. Given the track record that you've just outlined for me, do you think in the short to medium term we can realistically capture or recapture a meaningful slice of these two markets, or have we ceded too much ground already?
We can, but there's still a lot to be done. So yes, we can start to claw back some of it, but there's still a lot to be done. It's not going to be an overnight success story.
Thank you very much indeed. A very realistic assessment there. Leanne Back, Partner in Strategic Development and Advisory at the consulting firm BDO.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's health system continues to buckle under old problems and new pressures, from stalled reforms and staff shortages to ongoing uncertainty around the National Health Insurance Act. Health Funders Association Chief Executive Officer Thanisha Naidu is warning that unless urgent reforms are made, collaboration deepens and innovation delivers real outcomes, the country risks entering 2030 with a system that fails its people. He joins me now. By the way, the HFA is a non-profit organization representing key stakeholders in the private healthcare funding sector in South Africa. Thanisha, a very warm welcome. You argue that reform cannot wait. What, in your opinion, are the most urgent legislative or policy gaps that are holding back progress?
Great. Thank you very much, Jeremy. So firstly, you know, millions of South Africans need affordable access today. And everyone's been following the NHI debate. It's been contested in court. But the minister has stated under oath, NHI will take 10 to 15 years to implement. And we've heard, in fact, it'll take in various sessions as long as 35 years. So we cannot tell people who need healthcare now in 2025 to wait until 2040. And what the reality on the ground though is medical schemes, right, which offers instantaneous access to quality private healthcare is becoming more and more unaffordable. So medical inflation increases at CPI plus 3 to 5%, which is higher than salary increases. So we need reforms today, like moving towards value-based care. We need to implement health market inquiries, you know, and we need to introduce low-cost benefit options. Now, just to give you an idea, if we implemented those healthcare reforms now, medical scheme contributions could be reduced by 30%. And access to private healthcare could be expanded to 10 million South Africans. So, you know, these reforms have been written about and described many years. So it's not too late to implement. We can't wait for, you know, the NHI. It must actually be run in parallel. If we wait, you know, we might actually not have a healthcare system, but rather a healthcare crisis.
In fact, you go on to say that collaboration has now become a non-negotiable. All well and good, but what does real collaboration between public and private sectors actually look like in practice? Give me an example.
Sure. So I think, you know, to be honest, we've always had a challenge, you know, when we talk public and private collaboration. So we've kind of taken the stance, you know, what can we do, you know, that given that regulations take forever and for so long? So, you know, we've come up with some ideas and thoughts around can we, you know, look at introducing what is a proof point for low-cost benefit options that increases access? Take it on a plate and show how this could be, you know, the route for NHI to enable access to millions of South Africans, because we still fundamentally believe in NHI, just not the way it is done. Other options, you know, talk about collaboration. The private healthcare sector, you know, is well renowned, you know, it's probably in the top five. We've built, you know, hospital systems, we've built fraud, waste and abuse, the analytical skills, etc. You know, we can actually collaborate and show how does a health information system for 61 million people look like? What are the hurdles around that? So it's breaking down those technology barriers, sharing the technologies, you know, that we've built over time. So it's all of those things. And we've spent significant amount of decades, you know, being able to fund and design benefits. You know, all that skills and resources and coding is something, you know, we can collaborate around.
Is there any appetite behind the scenes from government to the proposals that you're putting on the table?
So you must say, to be honest, it's been disappointing. We've been knocking on many, many doors. You know, I think it's everyone's kind of focused on NHI. So it's not been the warm, welcoming piece that we want to. But, you know, I think that's my job. My job is to knock on every door until my last breath and make sure we build a healthcare system for all 61 million people. And so I think that's where I'm aiming to do what to do.
Part of the problem, of course, is one of perception. Critics often say that the private sector is more interested in profit than actually helping government. How do you counter that?
No, so absolutely not. No, so firstly, you know, if you go back in history, so medical schemes, you know, were conceived as part of the solution, you know, to achieving universal healthcare. It came back in the early 2000s. Medical schemes are not for profit. You know, and if you look at it, medical schemes, who they actually cover, it's a misnomer that, you know, it's for the elite. When we know that up to 84% of medical scheme members earn less than 40,000 Rand, and in fact, 40% of medical scheme members earn less than 16,000. Now, that is your working economy, right? The active engine of South Africa. And they contribute, you know, 74% of the personal income tax in South Africa. So what they actually do, you know, is by enabling access to them, you know, you're enabling productivity, enabling, you know, increase in economy, GDP, etc. So it's not about us versus them. It's in essence, right? We believe there's a world, and if you look across the globe, public and private coexist together. You know, unfortunately, many people have prophesied and wanting to kind of see the doom of medical schemes, but there was never the intention. It was meant to be, you know, coexist in unison. And I think there are absolutely ways that South Africa can work together and build a system for both public and private.
And if we don't act with the urgency that you are pronouncing and we don't achieve that alignment, what does the healthcare system look like in 5 to 10 years?
Sure. You know, and I think possibly what we're seeing today, you know, is probably going to be exponentially increased. So what we are likely to see is millions, you know, of people facing an affordability crisis because medical schemes inflations will continue to outpace salaries. So more and more people, particularly in the lower income salary brackets, will decide to simply opt out of private healthcare sector and only do so on a purchase of cash. Second thing, I think, you know, access, you know, for some of those essential services will be excluded because we do know the public sector has issues of access, and I see that worsening. And just to give you an idea, 16 million South Africans outside of medical scheme access private sector. Now, it's more, and that means our public sector is buckling, you know, with a reduced load. If more and more people go into the public sector, it'll literally collapse. I see quality erosion, longer delays in accessing care. And, you know, obviously the health of the nation will decline in 5 years' time.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Thonishan Naidu, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Health Funders Association.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, 10 years after the landmark Mbeki panel report exposed how Africa was bleeding money through illicit financial flows, the fight against corruption and dirty money should be higher than ever on the global agenda, but wait for it. At the recent G20 finance ministers meeting in Durban, corruption was left out of the communique and illicit financial flows barely mentioned. With South Africa hosting the G20 for the first time on African soil, this obviously raises tough questions about whether leaders are serious about tackling one of the continent's biggest development challenges. From Corruption Watch, I'm in conversation now with Janine Erasmus. Janine, a very warm welcome to you. So why do you think this issue barely featured in that communique? What's up?
Jeremy, we saw the same situation after the G20 leader summit in Rio in November last year. This was a huge, big summit. They released a declaration at the close of the summit, made a lot of many right noises, you know, regarding issues ranging from global conflict and equality and food security, but they barely mentioned corruption. Out of 85 paragraphs, the document was 22 pages long. Only one deals with and indeed even mention corruption. So, you know, this seems to be a G20 pattern whereby there seems to be an inability to understand that anti-corruption measures are vital for achieving the G20's own goals of poverty alleviation, progressive taxation, fairness and equality, and all of that. I mean, the Durban communique focused heavily on financial matters, global economy and trade, sustainable finance, working to lessen the debt burden on low and middle income companies. But as you've just said correctly, so there is no mention of corruption and only an oblique reference to illicit financial flows. You know, so we've got to ask ourselves, why is this? Is the G20 unwilling to confront these fundamental issues because they undermine its very own agenda?
So in answer to that question, then, what do you think the omission means for the G20 going forward?
We have seen that there have been indications from the US that it is going to scale down on G20 activity or on the G20 scope of activities. The South African presidency marks the first complete cycle of presidencies, goes back to the US next year. And we've seen that, you know, the tensions between SA and US, you know, because we're part of the BRICS group, these might all have affected the US participation in G20 activities in South Africa. But there have been reports elsewhere that the US seems to be focusing more on the financial track and the leaders track. So this means that other high-level working groups and meetings such as the environment, energy, health, anti-corruption are going to fall away. So this bodes ill for the G20 as a group taking any meaningful action on corruption and IFFs.
Does Corruption Watch think it's too late in any way to force this issue back onto the agenda?
It's never too late. I mean, I know that sounds like a platitude, but really it's we don't believe it's too late ever. You know, there is definitely scope for South Africa to still continue to push the issue at the G20. We, you know, we shouldn't allow our presidency, which comes to an end at the end of November, to hinder us from pushing these issues. It's really important. We're an African country. We're the first from Africa to hold the G20 presidency. We've got the standing to lead on IFFs. We're a regional financial and economic hub. We've got advanced technological systems which allow easy access to global financial markets for criminals as well as the genuine players. So we also have a responsibility to continue to play a part in fighting IFFs domestically, regionally, and continent-wide. So, you know, there's some important meetings still ahead before we hand over to the US. We've got the anti-corruption minister session on 30th of October. We've got the leader summit later in November. So we've still got the opportunity to push for this coordinated, bold G20 action and to remind fellow members of their power and their duty to tackle this threat. And those reminders should not end on the 1st of December.
Of course, your argument is predicated on whether South Africa, in its leadership position, has the wherewithal and the willingness to do that.
That is indeed the question. We, you know, dare I say it, we need leaders to show the political will to take this agenda forward and to show that they are prepared to actively develop the appropriate institutional responses, legal policy responses to contain and to stem IFFs. Our challenge is to ensure that G20 leaders keep this issue alive before beyond the end of November. And South Africa, unfortunately, doesn't have a great track record in walking the talk. We say a lot of things and we fall down often when it comes to the implementation stage. So, you know, time will tell whether this will, you know, continue to remain a high profile issue on the G20 agenda. We do have I do believe that we have the resources and we have the credibility. We can do it, but we just have to want to do it.
But the clock is also ticking very loudly because, as you rightly mentioned, the US holds the G20 presidency next year, and there must be concern that, given your earlier remarks to me, it could conceivably downgrade anti-corruption and IFF work even further.
Yes, it could. The G20 originally was set up mainly to discuss financial issues. That I think is pretty much its core mandate. So it seems that the US, I mean, there have been reports in the media, not just from our article that appeared in the Sunday Times yesterday, but from other media houses that the US does want to scale back on its G20 approach, focus more on, as I said, the financial track and the leaders track. So that's something that is quite possible. It's definitely part of the discussion out there at the moment.
10 years on from that Mbeki panel report, do you in any way think the world has made any meaningful progress on stopping these flows, or are we simply treading water here?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. It's always a tricky question. We have seen some positive developments. We know that IFFs are now a regular feature on global agendas. We know that beneficial ownership transparency is becoming what you might even call a must-have rather than a nice-to-have. And key stakeholders are much more aware of and sensitive to the impact of IFFs. And this is in both developed and developing economies. But I must point out that the AU's, the African Union's own high-level panel on IFF Secretariat, which they formed around about 10 years ago, recently, this year, issued a report highlighting the achievements and challenges that have been faced in the decades since the launch of the high-level report. And it acknowledges that there's a lot that can be done better and differently. They say things like the continent-wide response is still far too fragmented and inconsistent. Countries are divided on how to combat IFFs. There is an AU consortium to stem IFFs. That is also a grouping that has been going for the last decade, I think, as well. That work has slowed down since 2022. There could be many reasons for that. It could be capacity constraints. It could be, you know, the general sort of confusion and tension on the continent. It could be that donors are playing an increasingly intrusive role. But the consortium has struggled to function efficiently in the last few years. So that kind of central cohesion, you know, is dropping. Overall, there isn't much continental coordination and consolidation of a continental response to these issues. And this undermines efforts to combat IFFs, because we, as African countries, in our various individual domestic agencies, we don't have the capacity to tackle matters like this. And so it makes sense to work together. So we need to do more. We have definitely seen some things happening since that panel report, but it's not happening fast enough. We've got to remain agile, got to keep up with the criminals, because the criminals adapt as fast as technology allows them to, and they're very, very innovative. So we must keep up with that.
Janine Erasmus, thank you very much indeed from Corruption Watch. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.